From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the summer of 2007, when a doctoral student named Mehnaz Afridi traveled from her home on the West Coast to a conference in Germany. This story is told in the New York Times, which reported on a Muslim scholar who was looking to, quote, speak the truth. At that conference in 2007, Ms. Afridi delivered a paper on anti-Semitism in Egyptian literature. Then she drove to a site of a concentration camp in Dachau, Germany. It's a site that many Holocaust deniers mock. Afridi stood before the bricks of a crematorium and prayed, and she would later tell the New York Times that she did not know that particular moment would come to be so defining in her career, but she said that we have to understand the past, reject anti-Semitism, and even share the positive role of Muslims during the Holocaust. Mehnaz Afridi is going to be in Rochester on Thursday, participating first in a panel discussion on anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And on Thursday night, she offers the keynote in the annual Kristallnacht program at MCC. First, she's our guest on Connections. She's on the line with us. Dr. Afridi, thank you for taking the time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in studio with us, I want to welcome Rabbi Alan Katz from Temple Sinai, who will also be part of the panel discussion on Thursday afternoon at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. Rabbi, nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
And Dr. Mohammed Shafiq is here, who is a professor and executive director of the Hickey Center for Interfaith Studies and Dialogue at Nazareth College. Dr. Shafiq, always a pleasure to have you.
And great to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Afridi, I know that New York Times story this past winter got a lot of attention, and as you told the New York Times, you might not have known in 2007 that moment would be so defining for you. But, you know, for those of us who hear that it can be controversial just to acknowledge the Holocaust or to go to Dachau and to want to pray as opposed to deny what happened, we would think it shouldn't be controversial. Why is it controversial? Why do you think it's still controversial in some parts of culture?
There's a lot of layers and a lot of complexities in terms of that history, but I just want to say that, you know, as a Muslim, I'm taught to acknowledge other people's suffering, acknowledge, you know, all humanity as equal. And I think, and I felt, and I still feel frustrated that we have to deny each other's genocides or Holocaust. And I think for me, standing there at Dachau, taking that opportunity with my family to be there, I had to pray for those that, you know, lives were lost, meaningless, you know, in a very meaningless way. And then I started to think about survivors, and my journey began there and then onwards to interview survivors and talk to them about how they felt and also ask them questions about Islam. And I think when we deny each other's suffering, we're really denying each other's identity. We're denying each other's history and who we are, how we came to be, the questions that we struggle with in terms of the Holocaust or genocide. I have the same issue with Armenia in terms of Turkey. As a Muslim, I believe that Turks should be acknowledging the Armenian genocide as well. So, I it's controversial because it's almost as if we're giving and allowing others to see their own identity and their own victimization, and also controversial because of very recent modern history in terms of Israel, the establishment of Israel in 1948, which becomes also the Nakba for the Palestinians. So there's a lot of things going on. But what I think is really important for everyone to know, and especially maybe Muslim audiences, is that anti-Semitism is very old. It's an ancient problem. It's been there. It's there in the Genesis. It's there in all kinds of ways that creeps up again in the modern Arab and Muslim world. And what I'm trying to do is counter that and look at the stories during the Holocaust that can be positive, that can be encouraging, that I can show that there are people on the ground, Muslims like myself and others, that are trying to bridge these gaps.
Dr. Afridi is a professor of religion at Manhattan College, director of the college's Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center from Pakistan, a practicing Muslim. What is the kind of feedback, first of all, do you receive negative feedback, Dr. Afridi, for being a Muslim professor who's willing to stand up and say anti-Semitism is a very old problem and very real?
You know, I have to say that, you know, when I was first hired at Manhattan College, I had more negative feedback, but it wasn't from the Muslim or non-Muslim community. It was actually from the Jewish community and more so the Orthodox community. that really felt that they couldn't trust a Muslim in this capacity. You know, the memory is not mine. I clearly say that in my upcoming book. And I think it was probably a good backlash. And I think why it was good is because in the last 4 years, the community has embraced my work. They have begun to trust Muslims in this area. And I think there's always a first step. On the Muslim side, the Muslims have been very quiet. Some have been extremely supportive. But I think the backlash for me is going to be, why are you focused on the Holocaust? Why not the Nakba? Why not other genocides? That's always a question I have to deal with. And that's really, for me, it's not for me to do. It's for others to do. Maybe a Jewish scholar should look at the Nakba. Maybe the Jewish scholar should look at Bosnia. And I think I'm just tired of us always defending ourselves and our own issues rather than looking outside, because how else will we bridge those gaps?
And Dr. Afridi, I don't want to position this conversation for our audience in a way that would imply that a majority of the Islamic world denies the Holocaust. I have no idea what a common survey would look like. I think Americans are used to this cartoonish image of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, for example, as a prevalent denier. But I don't have any idea if we know just how much of the Islamic world, and however we want to quantify that, would deny that the Holocaust happened. Do you?
Well, I mean, I think it's not a denial. It's a relativization of the Holocaust. I mean, I've been approached by people who say, oh, you know, you study the Holocaust, and these are Muslims, and they say it was only 2 million, right? And to me, that's just crazy. I mean, 2 million is like saying that doesn't matter. There's a certain relative kind of attitude towards, you know, World War II and that other people died. That's right. But I argued that the Holocaust is actually unprecedented for several reasons. And I argued that because it went all the way to North Africa. I went to Greece. Jews were literally picked off every single country that the Nazi or the Vichy government could get hold of, and also living under fascism. So I think there's a particularity there, and I also feel that Jews who were persecuted throughout time, and especially during the Holocaust, never had a home. And I think those are the gaps I want to bridge, and I want to bring that history to the Muslim world and say, look, we don't really know the history of Judaism. We don't really know about Eastern Jews, we don't know about Arab Jews, we don't know about what happened in terms of immigration and migration. Some of us don't even know about the camps that were in North Africa. So for me, it's about education, and two, it's also about acknowledging that there was something like that that was in much higher numbers than 2 million. It's actually 6 million. We're finding out more and more that there might be other villages and other places that are just being uncovered by scholars in terms of Jews being murdered. So I think for me, it's not really so much the denial. It's the relativization. It's also the kind of images, not just in Iran, in other places that are diminishing the Holocaust, you know, and making IDF soldiers into Nazi soldiers. And whatever issue you have with Israel, I think that's really taking something that's immensely painful for Jews and putting it out there in a visual sense that says, you know, we don't really care what happened to you, and it's about us, or it's about a cause that's different from having a Jewish homeland. And I think that's where my problem is. I think we need to sort of look at this and say, we need to stop doing this, we need to start to acknowledge and accept each other's narratives, and I think that's the most important thing. If you can accept each other's narratives, you have to have a self-critical lens, and that's what I'm offering to the Muslim public.
Let me ask Rabbi Alan Katz from Temple Sinai in Rochester, who is also a member of the Commission for Jewish-Muslim Understanding. When you hear that she received some backlash when she gets this teaching appointment at Manhattan College, a backlash from the Orthodox Jewish community who felt like they couldn't trust a Muslim to teach on this, could you trust her to teach on this subject?
Yeah, I would have no problem as a recognized scholar. There are many non-Jews who teach on Holocaust and are very knowledgeable, understanding the situation and trying to learn and to teach. I can understand also why there is some backlash. And the reason the backlash is there is still the prevalent fear that we have not moved so far from the hatred that existed then to a totally new world where those things are not part of society in totality. So a person who may have had family lost still doesn't have the full sense of trust that there is a safety in the world in certain parts, and therefore anything that seems to penetrate that might attack a possibility of true scholarship would be looked at with question marks.
Listeners, if you want to join the program, we'd love to hear from you this hour. It's 844-295-TALK, and that's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're right here in Rochester, 263-9994. We've got Dr. Manaz Afridi on the line with us from Manhattan College, and again, she's a professor of religion at Manhattan and director of the college's Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center. Dr. Muhammad Shafiq is here in studio, the executive director of the Hickey Center for Interfaith Studies and Dialogue at Nazareth College, and Rabbi Alan Katz from Temple Sinai. All three of them will be part of a panel this coming Thursday, and it's free and open to the public. Starts at 1 o'clock at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester on East Avenue, free. And that panel is going to touch on anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And then Thursday night, Dr. Afridi is going to be presenting the keynote in the annual Kristallnacht program for MCC. That's a $7 ticket that you can get now. It's a 7 p.m. presentation. So that's all coming up. And Rabbi Katz, just what would you let our listeners know in terms of a brief history lesson for Kristallnacht, for example?
Well, Kristallnacht began the organized violence against the Jewish community in Germany. It was a start of what became the Holocaust. It was attacking Jewish institutions and people, arresting them, destroying their businesses, burning synagogues, and it began at this time. Today, November 9th, is the day when Kristallnacht began.
Okay, and that'll be Thursday night. And so let me get our first listener in here, and we're going to go around the panel and give everyone a chance to respond. I know Keith in Pittsford has a question for our panel. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, how are you doing?
Good.
I got a question, and I would like your guest to answer it objectively and hopefully truthfully. Do you think there'll ever be a time where people aren't killing each other on account of their religious differences? I personally believe that it's never going to change, and it's just going to get worse until we all, and when I say we all, until they all realize that religion isn't really what you think it is, that there's, you know, there's no supreme being. Nobody's calling the shots in your life. More of an atheistic or a secular view of life.
So, in other words, you're just asking if we think we're ever going to reach a time in human history where we will not kill each other over religion. Is that the question?
Basically, yeah. I mean, if you look at the history of, I think it was the Catholics and the Protestants were whacking each other for about 400 years in Ireland. I mean, it's just gotten progressively worse. Even Hitler thought he was anointed by God to lead the Aryan race. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on.
Okay, and Keith, before I let the panel jump in on this, are you potentially boiling this down too much to just sort of reduce it just to religion? Is there a chance that there are socioeconomics, politics, power all woven into some of the wars and the killing that you're talking about?
You're right, but everybody always, for example, if somebody kills somebody, well, it could ultimately go to socioeconomic reasons, but they start out based on religion, because let's say a religious group in a country is more powerful than another religious group and has an advantage economically, and they go to civil war on account of that.
Yeah. I take the point, Keith. I'm going to let the panel answer the question. And we can't, by the way, just think about every war, every act of violence is different. I mean, I'm already hearing from people saying Muhammad Atta and the 19 hijackers were pretty well off. I don't want to go down the road of every single analysis, but Dr. Shafiq, you can start with the response.
Keith, if you look into that, I think maybe another way that it becomes a socio-political issue, socio-political economic issue, and then religion comes into it. Maybe from that angle you can see how the killing happens. That's one way. The other thing is what you said is that can it come to an end? You know, good and evil, if you look into that, it is in religion, it's in politics, it's in every sphere of human life. So what we need to do, well, killing will be there one way or another way, whether it's political, it's economic greed or social issues or tribal issues. But I think those who believe in good, we need to continue to work. The more we work together, certainly the evil side will not grow. But if the good people sit in their homes and think that if they stay inside their home and do not do any good work outside, in other words, to take the message outside how to live together in peace, then we are giving up to the evil. So I think thinking positively and to be more engaged, I don't think at all that human will not kill at all in this life. As you see, Bible, Quran, or any sacred scripture says that the hereafter will be all peace. Never it says that there will be a total peace in this life. So how something peaceful will come in this life if all of us who believe in good of life, who believe that the good shall prevail and human virtues shall prevail, I think we need to shake hands and work together beyond our religions, beyond our ethnic, whatever we are, and beyond our, in other words, differences, how we can join and do the good work.
Rabbi Katz?
Yeah, I don't think it's, there's plenty of bad religion in the world and history, but it is not religion that is the problem. It's the view of hatred of the other. It is not accepting another person as having the same validity, the same humanity that you have. Once you see the other as an equal human, as an equal, then your religion will enhance that and not attack that. So there have been many genocides that have been not based on religion. Many of the Nazis were not religious people. They did not base their killing on religion. And if you took religion out of the picture, people would find other reasons, as they have had social experiments where people turn to eye color, height, as we know, skin color, of course, racism that is not based on religion, but just based on hatred of the other.
Okay. Dr. Afridi, I want to turn to you with this question, and I want to pose it in a slightly different way here, because I think what we need to do, I think it's valuable to help define what we mean by Islamophobia, because part of the panel discussion that you'll be joining on Thursday is anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. I have some listeners saying, listen, I don't want to be viewed as an Islamophobe, but I'm nervous that the hijackers on 9/11 were not suppressed. They were generally pretty well off, and yet they chose to follow their religion in a way that led them to kill innocent people, and they're scared about that. And so they're saying, I don't want to be an Islamophobe, but that scares me that it's not just the oppressed who might act in this way. So what is Islamophobia? Dr. Afridi, how do you define it?
Islamophobia, it's a term actually I don't really like to use much. Okay. I call it anti-Muslim sentiment. Islamophobia is a fear of Muslims, especially political Muslims. It's a recent term that was coined in 1996. There were, you know, certain kind of ruminations of it during the colonial times in 1926 by other colonial writers. It was looking at Muslims as Orientals, the other, the notion of them being backward and primitive. And it's sort of, you know, now it's a modern valence of Islamophobia. I want to say to your listener that who's scared and has fear of, you know, the hijackers, I mean, I just want to say I do too. So as a Muslim, I'm as fearful as he or she is. And I think one of the things that I want to explain to your listeners is that Muslims like myself and Dr. Shafiq are also targets. So it's not as if we have some kind of internal kind of conversation with these extremists, but we have an issue with, you know, and going back to your first connection where I can make a connection, is that religion is really an ideology. I mean, I teach religion and I say to my students, religion doesn't come and knock on your door. It's us. It's people who create religion. They create rituals. They create ways to believe, and they create violence and they create peace. So it's really up to Muslims and certain pockets of Muslims that have this issue. And the fear is very real. I'm sure that ISIS would like to probably exterminate me before anybody else, because they would probably see me as being an infidel because I, you know, have Jewish and Christian friends or people who don't even believe that are in my classes or my colleagues. So I think one of the things that I want your listeners to understand is that their questions are already separating people. So if you can understand that there's a diversity in the United States, which is why we can speak the way we do, because we have religious freedom, then we can understand that there's diversity within religions. There are diversities between stories of survivors. One of the main books that has been read widely by most people, and I hope some of your listeners, is Night by Elie Wiesel. And his question is, you know, he's watching, is God hanging by the gallows? I mean, how is this man in a camp still faithful in terms of God? And does he go through questions of God and faith? Of course. Do Muslims go through questions of God and faith? Of course. This is exactly what the challenge is of living. The existential core of living is about this challenge and looking at the suffering and confronting evil, sometimes in one's face. So if you talk to even survivors of genocide, and if you take Holocaust, which is really my focus, you have survivors who come out in a very strong belief in God, and you have a lot that say, you know, I don't believe in God because where was God when I was in the camps? However, they don't really differ ethically. They still care about the world. They're still out there with their powerful stories and encouraging young people to think. So I think we, all of us, have categorically created a stereotype of what we think religion is, just like what we think God will do. And one of the lessons in Islam, and I know it's true in Judaism, is that God is unknowable, unthinkable. And we, because we are egotistical human beings, we want to cage what God is doing. We want to cage what God is thinking. We want to cage the sacred text. And that's the challenge of being faithful. The biggest challenge, or the biggest jihad, is to really struggle with that inner moment of where you say, oh my God, I don't know anything, and I need to start over. But these are the ethical lessons I can learn from not just Islam, but Judaism and Christianity and other faiths.
Dr. Afridi, first of all, Dr. Shafiq, you want to weigh in here? Go ahead.
I just want to say that 9/11 was not religious. It was political. If you look into bin Laden history, initially he was opposed of American army presence in Saudi Arabia. And that's what he started his movement. And later on, after when the Afghanistan war was over, when Russia, USSR dismantled and all of that, and the U.S. government policy turned against him also. Then he became opposed to both the U.S., in other words, overall, what U.S. is doing in the Middle East.
It was political for bin Laden.
It was actually political.
But for all 19 hijackers?
Well, those people may have been influenced from his... they were all Saudis, if you look into that, are people who have lived in Saudi Arabia, Yemenis and Saudis, which has both close connections. So they were all sort of, maybe, I don't know much about that, perhaps inspired by bin Laden and what bin Laden was saying to have foreign forces in Saudi Arabia, that bin Laden is right on that. So I think... what I said before, that yes, religious connotation does come to strengthen the political initiative what the person is taking. So it is actually not religious at all. Religiously, I don't believe there is any problem. And Muslims and Christians and Jews have lived together for a long time. And now there are many books coming from the Abbasid rule, from the Jews, Muslims, and Christians together in Spain and other part of the world, how life was there and how they lived together. So religiously, to bring that Muslims are opposed religiously to either Christianity or to Judaism, I think that would be very wrong. The three religions religiously work together is real, like brothers and sisters. It's all political. It's all economic. Now, we can look together where that goes and how it comes, but the response, bin Laden response, was initially political. And certainly to strengthen his thesis, he has to bring religion into it.
Rabbi Katz?
Yeah, I love the perspective on religion that my friend Dr. Shafiq has, but I think we need to be self-critical, and we should be self-critical of our own religions. There is not a religion that does not have distortions and hatred and groups that follow that pattern, thinking it is based on the religion. So that
thinking very honestly, right?
Right.
Like Graham Wood said, when Graham Wood, the journalist, wanted to report on ISIS, he spent months talking to many people. And his conclusion, talking to people who have studied this, is that that they think they are following real religion, that this isn't a socioeconomic under someone's foot, that they think that they should be doing this based on a religious book. That was what he wrote for a February piece in The Atlantic.
Right. So, and I think we have to look at ourselves. I think Jews can look at ourselves because we do have factions, and we're much smaller people in number, and so maybe our numbers are much smaller, but we do have factions that think they have religious callings to do actions that we would call inhumane and hateful, and Christianity has a history of it. So to deny that is not being fair to a self-critical understanding of your of religious history. On the other hand, is the goals that Dr. Shafiq and the people who work in this community to build the bridges are, is to find the best aspects of religion and to use those because we believe that is what is true religion.
Dr. Afridi?
I have to say that, you know, there is a lot of different ways of looking at whether these acts are religious or not. I think the problem lies with what's going on in Muslim communities, and that can be defined as religious or socioeconomic, but I really think it's about ideology, and religion is part of ideology. So I also take the self-critical kind of stand where I look at my own self, my own community, and ask the question really hard and deeply, like, what's going on? Why are we interpreting Islam this way? Who's interpreting what for whom? And why has this become a justification? And why does this override, you know, all kind of human rights? So I think we have a lot of very deep issues to deal with in many of the Muslim communities. I mean, I'm from Pakistan. We have a lot of issues with the Taliban coming, infiltrating. We have a lot of things that we still need to deal with in terms of looking at how it is that we are looking at our faith and how it is that we are going to progress with our faith and move into the future where generations of ours can live in peace and not be committed to violence or committing violence against others. So I really do think that it's a time for Muslims, and you know, the term tazkiyah, which means self-reflection, is really important right now. Especially for Muslim women and young Muslims that are really kind of lost in terms of what is Islam and whose Islam is it. So I don't think the problem is Islam as a faith. I think the problem is Muslims, right? People who are following Islam. And I think that is where I'm getting to in terms of the existential issue that we're facing, at least in our communities around the world.
And I can't believe, I believe you. I'm not questioning you. But when you say, when you started teaching about, say, the Holocaust, you had more pushback from Orthodox Jews. But when you say the problem is not Islam, the problem is individual Muslims, and that there has to be rigorous self-examination, it's hard to believe that you aren't getting some pushback within the Islamic community on that, no?
I mean, if I am, I don't hear it. And, I am really grateful. And, you know, one of the things I want to say is that, you know, I just was at Merrimack College, which is in Andover, and I gave the Kristallnacht reflection there, and there were Muslims there. I met Muslims there. I'm inshallah, going to meet Muslims on Thursday. So here I am. You know, already things are progressing, and I'm so grateful that, you know, the Jewish community would say it's okay for, you know, Afridi to come here and reflect on a very, very important moment in history, which is Kristallnacht, but also for humanity. And I think this is the progressive things that people don't hear about. These are the stories you're not hearing, that Muslims are not saying, oh, you know, Afridi is going to sell out. I mean, there are people who say that, you know, I'm funded by Jewish money, but, you know, all kinds of things, but really on the general level, even after the New York Times article, I had about 10 Muslims from all over the world who said how proud they were of the work that I was doing, and it's about time someone did something like this. So maybe there are a lot of voices there that are buried, and I think we have to be positive about that change. I mean, I definitely feel very positive about the Jewish American community here in New York and other places that have really kind of, you know, embrace me in a way where they've said, you know, this is something that's going to create something positive and a bridge that between Muslims and Jews, and which is very, very much needed right now.
Dr. Afridi, the presentation that you'll be giving in Rochester on Thursday night, could you give that same presentation in Tehran, Cairo?
I could maybe in Cairo, but I don't think in Tehran, and it would depend. I think Tehran is seen again in a very severe way. I know people who are from Iran that are very progressive and think differently. I mean, I think there's a lot going on in Iran that there's a lot of fear. I mean, I was just at the American Jewish Committee Global Forum, and they're a really good group. But I mean, one of the things I came away saying to the directors and my friends was that, God, you guys are really scared. I mean, there's such fear. And that fear, I don't think Muslims understand. I don't think we have that fear in terms of Iran or other pockets of areas that, you know, Jews and Israelis are scared of. So, I can't say that. I mean, I'm not, you know, my mother says to me, come home and, you know, come and live here. She lives in Karachi, Pakistan. I said to her, okay, get me a job doing what I do and I'll come there, right? So, I mean, this is part of the problem. But I don't think this is going to stop, because I've seen now in the last year a lot of articles, even coming out of Palestine, saying we have to learn about Holocaust history. We have to recognize each other's narratives. So give it time. I mean, these things are not overnight. We can't solve these solutions overnight. I think the more and more voices, the positive voices you hear, I think it changes things. Just like media always focuses on negative issues, whether it's about Muslims or Jews or Christians. So we need to sort of rethink how we want to present material and look at the stories that are really buried and lost in the clamor of ISIS and the clamor of politics and the clamor of extremism. And that's where I'm at. I want to bring these stories up, and I'm lucky that there are people who are interested in learning about the Holocaust from a Muslim.
Let's take a short break, and we're going to come back with much more with Dr. Manaz Afridi, who's a professor of religion at Manhattan College and the director of the college's Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center. Dr. Mohammed Shafiq is here, a professor and the executive director of the Hickey Center for Interfaith Studies and Dialogue at Nazareth College. Rabbi Alan Katz is here from Temple Sinai. All three of them are going to speak at a free panel open to the public Thursday afternoon starting at 1 o'clock at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. They're talking about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And then Thursday night, Dr. Afridi delivers the keynote at the annual Kristallnacht program at MCC. Short break, more of your comments and questions and phone calls as well with our panel next. Coming up in our second hour, why did the judge dismiss the murder charge against Charlie Tan? What does that say about the justice system? And is District Attorney Sandra Dorley right when she says this was about privilege and this would not have happened for a city kid? Our panel discusses all of that and more, and we'll take your phone calls and comments as well on Connections.
Texas has no state-mandated minimum wage. Texas law forbids cities or counties from passing their own. That didn't stop a group of religious activists from making the case for a living wage for local government workers in San Antonio.
Asking for a decent wage is not unreasonable.
We'll hear about the fight later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Sarah writes to the program that she is listening to the show with a lot of hope. She appreciates the discussion we're having, and then she feels the hope deflated with the upcoming meeting between President Obama and Mr. Netanyahu. And Sarah says, it doesn't sound like there is any hope that there is any kind of an agreement coming between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Any efforts by the Obama administration appear to be failing. The tension is real. And so Sarah is weighing in on that. And look, that's certainly not my expertise. I will say I listened on NPR this morning to the president's press secretary saying there will not be a deal. There won't be a Palestinian state, certainly by the time the current president leaves office. And they are saying that's because Mr. Netanyahu is not open to the notion of a state, of statehood, and that this has not been a very smooth relationship. So, Rabbi Katz, I'll start with you. Sarah writes to the program and says what she's hearing from you and Dr. Shafiq and Dr. Afridi gives her some hope, but then she sees the leadership in Washington, the leadership in Israel, and she doesn't feel that hope in that part of the world.
I'm going to go back to something that was mentioned before, and that is the fear Jews have. The fear is, within the lifetime, I was just with my father on an honor flight to Washington. He was a World War II veteran. So in his lifetime, there was a fear created because one-third of the Jewish world was exterminated. One-third of the Jewish world was murdered. So for Jews who are less than 20 million people in this world, I mean, much less than that, there is that fear of a reality that there can be a destruction. And because of that, there are people like Netanyahu and others in Israel who don't rule out the possibility of a massive destruction of the Jewish people in those kinds of numbers. It can't be seen in the same way from Christians or Muslims, because you're talking about numbers that are in the hundreds of millions. We're not talking about those numbers. And so that fear exists, and that's why, even though, you know, there are different opinions on the politics, and I'm not going to get into my politics with Netanyahu at this point, there is a sense that in Israel, you still have the reality that the entire people of Israel could be wiped out, and therefore there is the need for a certain type of strength, and that's why some of the negotiations have not gone well. Does that mean there's no hope? Well, I'm not a person who says there's no hope, and I'll go back to even the national anthem of Israel, which is called the Hope HaTikva.
Dr. Shafiq?
You know, I was in Israel sometime in January, and I heard both sides and what they were talking about. And the Israeli side, the way the person presented his argument, he said it's not difficult between Palestinians as a whole and Israelis as a whole to have a peaceful solution of the issue. In other words, the two-state solution. It's a political will. And because of the lacking of the political will and political authority from both sides, that they have not been. In fact, he was saying, he was sort of a negotiator also, he was saying that we both agreed on the two-state solution. The papers were ready, but from the both sides, there was no political will to have signed, in other words, afraid of what their constituencies are and whether they would be able to sign that. So I think the hope is still there. I think what we need is American Jews and American Muslims, and also, you know, over there, what can happen? I think building better relations, building, and including Christians, because, you know, Israel and Palestine both have Christian Jews and Muslims together. So our mutual relation, the more we strengthen interfaith dialogue here, it will have eventually an impact. A sincere interfaith dialogue, which we do, and people see how we work with one another, it will have an impact on the fear which is there in Israelis' minds, which coming from Holocaust and which we shall understand, and the Nakba, which is, you know, the Palestinian, how they feel the fear that perhaps they will be totally eliminated. I mean, that fear is there also. So how this interfaith dialogue in America building good relations, that's one way. You know, some people said in Israel and Palestine that if America use, the White House use its full power, it can happen. It should say, it should dictate. I don't know whether that is the way or not, but the way is through negotiation. And I always say when I'm in Israel, I say, how about like this? God has given you power today, and Palestinians are powerless, have no, you know, how about fatherly relations with them, good relations with them, to be compassionate towards them and win their hearts. By winning their hearts through providing them basic facilities and things like that, listening their, you know, suffering, eventually they will see we are brothers together and sisters together. Let's live together in peace and things will happen. So I think some steps needs to be taken of that brotherly and sisterly love between the two people. In America, I think we need to strengthen interfaith dialogue to work on it.
Dr. Afridi?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I really think that if each this sort of like political inaction, paralysis of negotiations, they're constantly persisting, the political positions, you know, the parties grow further apart, there's mistrust, like, you know, Rabbi Katz says there's fear, I think there's a lot of anger as well. And, I mean, until both sides are not willing to acknowledge the other's religious, cultural, and existential narrative, nothing's going to happen. So, I mean, if Jews or Israelis in Israel are not going to accept the Nakba or accept the displacement of also Palestinians, just like the Palestinians will not accept sometimes even the state of Israel, nothing can happen. So I think, again, I mean, this is why I think it's so important to work on self-critical lens and to really speak up for the other. You know, I don't think it's my duty to just speak out as a Muslim, but it's my duty even more as a Muslim to speak out for Jews. It's my duty more as a person living in the United States to say, hey, stop that anti-Semitism, or hey, not all Israelis are like that, and not all Israelis agree with each other. And that's sort of, you know, where we have to break the narrative. Or to say to my Jewish friends, well, why don't you talk to my other friends who are Palestinians that have different narratives, that are not out there to shoot rockets at you, that don't align with Hamas, that want to create peace, that have dreams and aspirations of becoming doctors and lawyers and teachers. I mean, these are important conversations that are never had, because extremism is violent. You know, it can kill people. And this is why we're always under the auspices of the extremist voices. And these narratives get lost because we're not ready to accept each other's narratives. And I think that one, when we are not ready to accept each other's narratives, you can't do much. I mean, I was also in Israel a long time ago, and I was at the Jerusalem Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and I went to the Palestinian areas, as well as I was in this program, which was all basically Jewish, but it was people from all over England and Africa and everywhere. And, you know, I slipped in and out of both of these identities very easily, and at that time I was carrying a Pakistani passport, which was kind of strange because Pakistan does not recognize Israel and vice versa. So the Israeli embassy told me that, listen, you're going, you're on your own, we can't help you because you have a green card. I said, that's fine. You know, you're young, of course. You know, I didn't get into any trouble. I came home safely. But, you know, I had to carry my passport everywhere. And when I would bring it out, people just couldn't believe that I was amidst them because, you know, the Pakistani passport, it says Pakistan Republic, the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. That's kind of scary for people to see. It's not something they saw. And that's another thing. I mean, I'm not talking about the physical wall, but we've erected walls where we are not intimate with one another. We don't eat with one another. We don't talk to one another. We don't sing with one another. So if you have dehumanized each other to that extent where you actually do have a physical wall, where are you going to go for that? So, I mean, my hope is not hopelessness, but I think the narrative has to change. And I think people like your listener who are feeling desperate in terms of this has to look for those stories. There are stories even during what's been going on the last couple of months where children, Israeli and Palestinian, have gone together. Parents who have lost their kids have gone together and created huge demonstrations of peace. There are people who have come out in the streets and said, stop this rhetoric. So where are those stories? Why aren't we listening to this? And Sarah, I think you're a listener. You have to look for those stories because those are the stories that are going to win eventually, because winning is not about extremism or dehumanizing someone. Winning is about peace, and it's about living with that peace. And it's not a peace that will last forever. We'll have another cycle of some kind of turbulence. So we have to start to look at this in a way that's very different and outside of the speech of Netanyahu or Hamas or any of these leaders that are really also, you know, rallied because of their own constituencies.
Let me get back to the phones. Dan in Brighton has been waiting to join the conversation. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, I'll do the second.
Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Here I am.
There you are. Go ahead, Dan.
This morning I read that 5 Shiites were killed in Afghanistan. It doesn't matter who killed them, some Sunni group. I'd like to know if there's any effort to get the various Muslim groups to tolerate each other. And secondly, perhaps you could explain the difference between the Sunni and the Shiite, and I'll hang up to listen to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. I don't know if we have enough time to really explore the differences between Sunni and Shia. Dr. Shafiq, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, I was supposed to do presentation also in Washington, D.C. in the coming days. If you look into the Shia-Sunni differences, it came to be political differences. As you see, when the prophet died, there were certain people that were thinking that since the Prophet had no son, so Ali, who was his son-in-law and close relative also, he should be the successor. While other tribal leaders and others thought, no, let's have some election, some sort of selection and election. So, well, people got together and from different areas, and they finally did not go on the succession policy. They went on the electing sort of Abu Bakr to become the first caliph. If you look into Ali's life, he was very much a close sort of lieutenant or close, very closely working with Abu Bakr and then with the second caliph, with the third caliph also, they were all together. But after that, when especially his Ali's son, who was the grandson of Muhammad, peace be upon him, and he was assassinated in, I think, somewhere 60-62, then the Shia, really this whole concept of Shia emerged, that the whole thing was wrong. It should have been Ali. So, in other words, the Sunni-Shia split came after that, so some 60 years after that. And how, and that split then went in, there was some theological, religious differences also which came into that. But mostly, if you look and study it, it was political differences that it came into being. Now, if you look into the issues right now, whether it is in Iraq or Afghanistan or other parts of the world, the Shia-Sunni issues become hot when there is economic injustice, political injustice, and things like that. In other words, political oppression. When it happens, the religious things comes into being also. Otherwise, when the country is politically stable and economically doing well, you can see how the Shia and Sunni work together in those parts of the world. So those things you can see, and certainly there is work going on quite a bit. In other words, those extremist movements who are working to see these differences should increase, and also this assassination, the way it happens, you know, different governments are taking steps how to eliminate that.
All right, a question on the Holocaust. Alan Churchville has been waiting with a question for Dr. Afridi. Go ahead, Al.
Hi, Evan. I really enjoy your show.
Thanks.
Recently, Benjamin Netanyahu was quoted as saying the seeds to the Nazi Holocaust were planted by a Muslim. And I'd like your guest to comment on that, and I'd also like the guest to comment on why there hasn't been more of a Muslim worldwide outcry on the illegal settlements that the Israelis are doing in the West Bank area.
Al, thank you for the phone, Carl. And Dr. Afridi, I'm not familiar with the Netanyahu comments, I guess, allegedly on the seeds of the Holocaust. Are you familiar?
Yeah, yeah. I actually responded to those comments and was quoted in the Jerusalem Post and in the CNN article. So I just want to clarify that. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu has since then rescinded his comments. But he was referring to the Mufti al-Husseini, which he met in 1942. And he met him briefly over the resettlement of Jews from Palestine that were already coming in, starting really in terms of migration from 1922. So one of the problems in terms of this misquotation is that it just fuels more anger and more resentment with each other. What the real historical accuracy is that the Mufti had nothing to do with the Jewish solution, which was extermination of all Jews. Granted, the Mufti was anti-Semitic. He was not happy with the Jewish migration, and that the Nazi propaganda machine was in the Arab world actually very early on and going very hard in 1933 all the way up to 1942 in terms of gaining an ally. So one of the things that maybe you haven't read is that a lot of people have come out and actually corrected Netanyahu, including Jewish scholars and Muslim scholars and others. So I think that that's one issue. It doesn't mean that the Al-Mufti was not anti-Semitic or had resentment towards Jews, but it was not the Mufti, nor were the Arabs the instigators of the Holocaust, nor had the, did the Arabs have knowledge of the death camps. And the knowledge that they did have, actually, you can come and hear me on Thursday. I'm going to talk about that and talk about how we can reconcile through these issues and what the Arabs did know and not know during World War II. In terms of your second question of settlements in the West Bank, there has been an outcry. There has been desperation. There has been a lot of push on looking at how many more settlements are going to come into the West Bank. I'm not really there to be a politician, but I think there is going to be a lot of pushback on that, not just from Palestinians, but from a lot of neighboring countries.
Well, and we're going to be out of time here. Here, according to CNN, the quote from Netanyahu was, Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at the time. He wanted to expel them. And Haji Amin al-Husseini went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll all come here. What should I do with them? Hitler asked, and Husseini said, burn them. But within his own country, he's faced a lot of pushback. Mr. Netanyahu has for those comments. So, Al, I guess... That has been a controversy, and there's so much more to say on this subject. I mean, this is just one of those days where Dr. Afridi, even with an hour with you, I know it's not enough. And we'll see you on Rochester on Thursday at the Jewish Federation at 1 o'clock for the Anti-Semitism and Islamophobia panel. Then MCC is still selling tickets, jewishrochester.org for that event, MCC online for $7 if you want to see Dr. Afridi on Thursday night in her keynote on Kristallnacht and Jewish-Muslim reconciliation. Dr. Afridi, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Rabbi Alan Katz, thank you, sir, from Temple Sinai. See you again soon. Thank
Great
you.
Great to be here.
And Dr. Shafiq, we'll see you Thursday as well.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You. Thank you. Short break and more connections next.